Okay, welcome back. Part two with Jim Morris and Dick Allgaier. Jim is hearing things that just must be music to his ears after all these years. We have to move on. We've got one of the three men that Dick Allgaier saw nailed down as Lee Harvey Oswald. But I was just thinking during the break, Jim and Dick, how Lee Harvey Oswald must have felt having been betrayed, set up, and knew he was going to die.
Yeah, had to be terrible. I felt what he felt because when I got next to him, some of his thoughts, like if I can think Spion, I was thinking his thoughts. He wasn't sure he was going to die. He didn't know what was going on. He was confused. He was frightened.
But I'm sure he was stunned.
He'd been reporting back. He thought he was in control of the situation, and now he realized it's totally out of his control, and he didn't know who to turn to.
Yeah, that's what I felt. I was going to make a quick point before we went to break, before we leave Oswald. I was a police reporter like Jim. I've had an office.
Like
in
Jeff,
the police
too.
Department. Yeah, well, all of us.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've covered five presidents. I've been close enough covering presidents as a reporter to spit on them, and I won't tell you which ones I wanted to spit on them, I can tell you that when Obama comes to town in Hawaii, there's a concern over the overtime that they have to pay the police. Mm-hmm. When the president comes to town, and if the president comes to town and gets shot, they don't have police officers to send to a damn theater because someone snuck into the theater.
Exactly. That's right. That's right.
Exactly. So, all right, can I request that we skip Human 2 and go right to Human 3? Because Human 2, that's going to be the one that blows everybody away.
All right, that's good.
Okay.
Good counsel.
And when we talk about those, I don't think we've mentioned this. You can go to Jeff's site, and under guests, there are photos under Jim's name and under my name.
Yeah, please load those up.
The sketches that I do.
Yeah, and you can see the sketches and the likenesses. And I think you're going to be quite amazed. Just go to guests at Rent and take a look.
So I'm looking at this target. I'm sketching what I see. Then I go back and I get my mind right and I look again. And the next thing I saw was this black car. And you'll see the significance of that if you go to the Farsight website and go to Vimeo and pay to watch the video. I got to do that plug. But I saw this black car going through the night. It was a 1950s car. It had tail fins. It had chrome bumpers, grill. It looked like a Buick, a Cadillac, that kind of car. It was a misty night. I felt that it was in Washington. There was a man in the back, and he was going to an urgent meeting at night.
Was he being chauffeured?
I followed that. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so I drew that. I saw that car so vividly. It was like the opening of a film noir movie. It's a dark night in Washington and a limousine goes by, but it's in the 1950s.
Like now, it's always 50s, a dark early. Night in Washington, Dick.
Yeah. Then the next thing I saw was, you know, your awareness kind of goes down and an image swims up into your vision. My eyes are closed and I'm looking and this face forms up. And I saw this older guy that was jowly with a bad haircut, combed back with, you know, hair oil, too closely cropped on the sides, gray like he may have colored it on top. And a fleshy face and really beady eyes.
Pretty
and
homely looking guy. Uh-huh.
Yeah, scary looking guy. And mm-hmm. So I drew him. And it took me five or six tries to where I got him how he really felt that I saw him. You know, I've got these pages. I should publish these.
You should.
You can see I first draw an oval, and then I draw it again. I go, no, his eyes felt more like, it's just like a police sketch artist kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah. You can see this in the video, folks. You can get this video and watch Dick doing all this stuff.
So, actually, in the video, I don't think I draw him on the video because I had drawn him on paper
okay.
a bunch of times, and I wanted to get it just like I thought I saw him. Now, you've got to understand that when I'm doing this, nowhere in this video, nowhere in this session do I make any conclusion about, oh, JFK, oh, they're plotting to kill the president. That never crossed my mind. It was just, I see these people, what are they doing? So given the cueing of the thing, it's like I get these individual strings, a thread, and I pull on that thread and see where that goes. But I never, ever put it together. I never said, oh, this is the plot to kill JFK. I never said, oh, they're plotting to assassinate someone. I just said, they're concerned about this guy. This guy is an evil son of a bitch. He orders people around. Like, here's what comes to me in this session. Stuff like, oh, there's an ashtray on the table. People smoke in that office. Well, people don't smoke in offices anymore. So that's an anachronism. Like, why does the room smell like cigarette smoke? And there's people, I don't know if this guy smoked, but people in his office did. The phone was made of, what did they call it? Bakelite?
Bakelite.
Bakelite.
It had a rotary dial, but it was on it like, sir, line one. And then when I got on the phone, I think I said something like, oh, the attorney general's calling, or attorney general on line one. He orders people around. He's concerned about the attorney general. So I got a sense of it was a powerful man that was doing something with some other. There were people above him, mm-hmm. people he gave orders to, mm-hmm. and he had some concerns. But never, never did I think, oh, this is somehow tied into Kennedy. When I got done with the session, I went, I don't know who these guys are, and I don't know why I'm seeing them, or if I've even answered the question in the tasking. I thought I was going to turn this in and be told, well, you need to do more work. You need to go find something else. And I had no idea what I would be looking at. Instead, I was told, okay, you're done. And I went, I am? Okay. Well, you'll get feedback in 3 weeks. Okay. And I went on and did something else. So that's my story on that, Jim.
Well, all I had to do was take one look at it, and it's obviously J. Edgar Hoover. And everything that you said, of course, matches with Hoover. He did drive a black Cadillac, and I'm sure he was chauffeured around. To tell you a great story I heard from an FBI agent who actually ended up writing a book called No Left Turns. Hoover was such a pusillanimous person that at one point he had been involved in a slight car accident, and from that point on for the rest of his life, he never would allow his drivers to make a left turn. They could only make right turns because he'd been in an accident.
And he never had another accident either,
and,
did he?
Because his drivers were there, but they had to make a right and another right to go left, you know. That's what kind of creep this guy really was. And, of course, everybody now knows about the fact that he was trying to run everybody because of all the files he had on everyone.
Right.
The other thing, and he had a big spacious office, and I'm sure he had one of those telephones with line 1, 2, 3. All of that makes perfect sense. And he also, the thing that you have to keep in mind is that he was neighbors and close friends with Lyndon Johnson, the man who took over as president when Kennedy was killed. And both of these men, Johnson and Hoover, can be proven, not just alleged, but proven to have taken actions that blocked any meaningful investigation into the assassination, which under our legal system makes them accessories after the fact. And Dick, I know you, being a crime reporter, you understand in our legal system, if you're an accessory, if you took the gun, hid the gun, drove the car, you knew about the crime, you're as considered just as guilty as the person who pulls the trigger, right?
That's there right. are guys down in Texas that are on death row for doing that.
Exactly.
Just, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for being accessories. Okay, so, you know, you could, Hoover was an accessory because the FBI took photographs, took films, suborned testimony from witnesses, suppressed evidence, fabricated evidence. All of this is demonstrable and provable. And so he obviously was near the top of the command structure for the assassination. So I have to say you hit a direct hit right there.
Well, I never put that together when I did the remote viewing session, and not even until tonight. What I did was I was given a target, and I looked and I saw some people doing some things, like driving and then meeting, talking on the phone, and talking to another younger guy, and I drew what I saw. I never said in the session, oh, this is J. Edgar Hoover, and he was in on the, they was plotting the president's assassination. When you remote view, you're not omniscient. You know, you don't get the whole story. You get little, it's like sometimes it's like going into a movie and looking through a paper towel holder, you know, the tube, you know, and you look up at the screen and you see one little face on the screen, and then you have where you can't look, and then 2 minutes later you look at something else, and then you don't know what the plot of the movie is. You just know, oh, I saw this guy and he looked like this.
Yeah, but Dick, so didn't you identify that you made a very graphic description of the car and the fog and the night and the, you know, but didn't you also say that you got the impression this was Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, we heard that.
Because people, when you remote view, stuff just bubbles up into your consciousness. Like, I didn't say it's Washington. I said it looks kind of like, you know, I've never been to Washington, but I think it's got low buildings with big sidewalks. Where I saw was the building was farther back. It wasn't a crowded street like Dallas or New York. There was space from the, it was a wide road with a big lawn, and the buildings were set back kind of thing.
Well, right, and there's plenty of wide, grassy areas in Washington, and some of the more prominent buildings are spaced far apart. It's not like New York or downtown Dallas, as you say.
Okay, question. So, we've looked at human number two. Jim says it's obviously J. Edgar Hoover. You folks can click on photos.
Human number three.
I beg your pardon, number three. And how is this screenplay unfolding? How did you move from where you were, the man under the awning, Lee Harvey Oswald, to what appears to be Washington? Does the scene just change in front of you?
No. Here's how it goes, Jeff. In the way I remote view, you start with very low-level stuff. So I've already done some work. And I'm looking at, I saw one person who was the young guy walking on the street. And so I wrote down on my paper, okay, human one. Then I see this other guy in the car. I see the car, and I write down, like, structure or vehicle.
So there's no big break in continuity. You're just moving along, recording what you see.
But I write it down, and then what I do is I go back and look at each thing again and turn, okay, I want to look at this, the first human, this first guy. And then I want to go look at the second guy. Then I want to look at the third guy. And then when I put it on video, I felt they all somehow were related, and I just drew them all at once and said, okay, how are they related?
That's how they were presented to you in the session, in other words. These things just come to you. They bubble up through your consciousness.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's go on to number three.
Yeah. That's
number two. Beg your pardon.
Okay. This guy was I saw him clearly. He was young, clean cut. He looked like a preppy. That's what I said. He's a preppy.
Where was he?
He.
Where was he? Same city as either one of the other two?
He was not associated. The guy that Jim feels is Oswald wasn't with them in a meeting. They were thinking, the two of them were, I don't know if they were like in the same place, but they were connected and they were concerned about him. I think that's the way I said it. Like, they're doing something with him. And the idea that I got was that these two guys want to be sure that whatever happened with him can't be connected to them. I think I said firewall. And if you look at the last sketch, I drew, when I'm on video, I drew like four or five lines. I said, there's firewalls. And I drew one, two, three, four. Now, when you do something like that in remote viewing, that's your subconscious. You don't consciously know it. I'm just drawing lines. And what I think those lines represent are lines of defense, like firewalls.
Insulation,
like there was,
sure.
Insulation to keep that guy could not any way be connected to them.
Compartmentalized.
Apparently they missed a few, if Jim is right, which I didn't know about, that Hoover was had sent a memo about him, what he said in the first hour. But now, I'm not saying, looking, I never said anything in the session about, oh, these guys are planning this. And I think this was just, if you're looking at the planners, these are two or three threads in an entire tapestry. I personally, and this isn't remote viewing work, I think it goes higher. And I said in the session, there's people above them, there's people below them. They answer to someone higher. So what I wanted to ask Jim was, whoever gave authorization probably didn't plan it. You know what I mean? If these level of people were in on the planning, they weren't necessarily in on the authorization. And this is not remote viewing data. Nothing in my session says that. But Jim, tell us about that.
Well, I think you're absolutely 100% correct. Well, let me, first off, on human number two, in the video, you mentioned skull and bones. Where did you get that?
It popped into my head at that moment. I blurted it out because when I looked at him and I touched the board, which is a probing technique, the word skull and bones
popped out.
Came into, yeah.
Okay. Now, keep in mind, number one, that I've done remote viewing myself. In fact, I even taught remote viewing at one time. And so, obviously, I think I've got some pretty good intuition. And when I first looked at the picture, without any of the attributes that you came up with, I immediately thought that looks like a young George Herbert Walker Bush. And then you mentioned he's a preppy. He was. And then you mentioned he was a member of Skull and Bones, which he was. Now, and then you mentioned the firewalls and the insulation, and that Bush was concerned because he didn't want to be connected to Oswald. And I doubt very seriously that we will ever come up with any kind of hard evidence that would connect George Herbert Walker Bush to Lee Harvey Oswald. But Bush was in Dallas at the time. I have him in the Adolphus Hotel the night before meeting with Richard Nixon. Bush was a very prominent Texas oil man. His oil company, Zapata Drilling, was one of the fronts that the CIA used to initiate the Bay of Pigs invasion. In fact, the two ships that were damaged.
What, Barbara and what was the other one?
Barbara and the Houston.
Yeah.
Okay. In fact, his oil company was Zapata Drilling, and the whole Bay of Pigs operation was codenamed Operation Zapata. All right. His father, Prescott Bush, had helped create the CIA. So there's really no question that George Herbert Walker Bush was probably well connected into the CIA, even long before the Bay of Pigs invasion, which explains why that in the mid-70s, with our unelected president, Gerald Ford, suddenly selected this Texas oil man, George Herbert Walker Bush, to head the Central Intelligence Agency. So he was mixed up in all of this. Mm-hmm. Now, I doubt seriously if George Herbert Walker Bush had any direct contact with Lee Harvey Oswald, but I feel very certain because of his contacts with oil people, with Dallas, and with the anti-Castro Cubans, that he was probably well aware of Oswald. And he also probably would have represented the Texas oil men in any meetings or deals to set up the assassination, because the Texas oil men, number one, were very conservative. They considered Kennedy a East Coast liberal. They thought he was probably pro-communist. They knew that he was not going to send ground combat troops to Vietnam and expand that war, and they all had interest in the defense industries in Texas. But the most important thing is Kennedy had actually talked about doing away with the oil depletion allowance, which is the bedrock of Texas oil money. So the oil men wanted him out of there. And I could see perfectly well that George Herbert Walker Bush, with his connections in Washington, with his connections through the CIA, would have been in a perfect position to act on the best interest of the Texas oil people.
Well, and you also remember from our last session that George Herbert Walker Bush took Junior to Dallas on the 22nd.
Exactly. In fact, there is a controversy going on. I think it's been pretty well established that he was in the Dallas area at the time. But there's a controversy over a photograph of a man standing out in front of the that was taken at the time of the assassination.
Yeah.
Of a man standing in front of the Texas School Book Depository, and I would never convict anybody on the basis of some
of that
fuzzy
picture.
Photograph, a person in the background of a photograph, but it certainly looks like George Herbert Walker Bush. And then to add to this controversy, they have come up with a picture of a young man in bobby socks wandering in Dealey Plaza at the time of the assassination, looking like he's kind of like he's looking for somebody. And it's been theorized that this was George W. Bush, that his dad had taken him to Dallas and then got separated because there is a thought that he was might have been some of those dozen of people that were picked up by the police at the time, mm-hmm. but then quickly let go when they decided they were going to hang it on Oswald.
Wow. Okay.
So, well, you know, Jim, when I got the feedback on this target, and it was like...
We're going to go through the break, Todd. Thank you.
Long after I did the sessions, and this is what the remote viewer lives for, is you do these targets over the course of a few months, and you're going, what the hell was that? You know, and I'm going, Courtney, when do I find it? Well, we'll let you know in 2 weeks. Daz has got to finish up. And then, okay, Daz is done. And then he sends me the feedback, and I see that this was the highest organizational planning meeting orchestrating Kennedy. And I looked at my work, thought, ah, I blew that one. I mean, I would have thought, why didn't I draw Alan Dulles or...
Exactly.
Who's the mafia guys? Like, why didn't I draw Carlos Marcello or, you know, the standard thinking about who planned it would have been the head guy at the CIA,
mm-hmm.
Along with the mafia or something. Is that just disinformation that's been put out there?
No. You said it yourself, Dick. You're looking through the tunnel, okay, and you're only seeing certain sections of this. And by the way, I wasn't going to get into Dez's thing, but he has this meeting take place between government types and between other types, all in suits, but that were not quite so sharp and government type people. And I think that would have been meetings between possibly either low level CIA people or more probably between organized crime people. Now that brings us back to Hoover. Hoover was thoroughly blackmailed by the mafia. They probably had pictures of him in his tutu. Plus, he was seen on numerous occasions meeting with these top mafia guys. I think that he was getting a, I think they had him blackmailed, and I think he was getting money from them. He would go out to the Belmont racetrack, and he would go up and be seen placing bets at the $10 window, but his agents would be going up placing bets at the $100 window, and I think that's where they were paying Hoover off. And the proof of that is that until the Kennedy brothers took office in government, Hoover, as head of the FBI, kept maintaining there was no such thing as the mafia. There was no organized crime in this country. And it was only after Bobby Kennedy brought Joe Valachi to Washington about 1961, and he started spilling his guts, that the whole country finally learned that, yes, indeed, there is an organized crime network in this country.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow. It's amazing what a, I was only 10 years old at the time, but what a naive society we had back then.
Yeah, it was easy. It was happy, Dick.
Right.
It's not all negative.
There was organized crime, and there was, I'm sure, corruption in government, but it was all small time, okay? And even the mafia, yeah, they operated in New Jersey and some in New York and in Chicago, but in Dallas, there was a big gang war going on in the 40s and 50s because the gangs in Chicago and in New Orleans were trying to take over the crime in Texas, and the local crime and the local thugs were fighting it out. So, yeah, it was there, but it didn't really affect the average person. The average person was happy. The average person was making money. The economy was sound. I mean, you know, the 60s was a pretty neat time to be in, and then it just, the Kennedy got killed, and then the whole thing started coming apart, and you had the hippies and the anti-war demonstrations and other assassinations, and we just, we kind of lost our innocence.
Yeah.
We certainly did. Well, what I've always wanted, when I did the first part of this target, and it focused on the guys doing the shooting, and it struck me how cold you would have to be, and how confident in the control that your controllers had, that you could pull the trigger on the president. And I mean, it took some brass balls to pull that trigger, those guys who...
Well, Dick, let me tell you, I interviewed James Files in Joliet Prison, who has admitted that he was the Grassy Knoll gunman. Now, there's still some argument over that, and there will be. That's been the cover-up. The cover-up is not the lack of evidence. The cover-up's in obfuscation. There's just so many claims and counterclaims out there that the average person goes, gee, I don't want to hear any more about
right,
this.
Right.
But Files, he was just a good old boy from the South. And he was recruited in the Army. They sent him to Southeast Asia. I think it was Laos. And this was long before the, this was back in the 50s, before the Vietnam War really got cranked up. And they trained him to be a sniper. They trained him to kill. In fact, he wrote a letter back to his mother and said, Mom, they're turning me into a killer. And sure enough, you know, after you've been had enough training and after you go out and shoot enough enemies in the head, it becomes kind of second nature to you. It's like, okay, I got another job here. Got shooting somebody else in the head. Okay. See, you and I and Jeff and every, a decent moral person, we would cringe at the thought of having to kill somebody. But if you've had the training and if you've had the experience long enough, you get pretty cold-blooded.
Well, you look at some of these videos of ISIS slaughtering innocent people with AK-47s in the Middle East, and you get the idea that some people are just sociopathic and they just don't have any calmness. The videos of the 10-year-old kids with guns pointed at the back of the heads of people that they were executing, they were teaching children to do this.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of kids do you think they're going to grow up to be? Killers.
Yep.
That's it.
Well, yeah. So who gave the... Here's the thing that I don't think this... I know my remote viewing didn't answer this question. And maybe it's a greater... We're coming to a greater question, you know, a bigger issue. Who would have originated this idea? Who would have said, let's kill this son of a bitch? The president. I think we're going to assassinate.
Yeah, I think that. I think that, Dick, I think that originated at the simultaneously in several different groups. The mafia, I know they're that's on the record, you know, them saying, take the stone out of my shoe, right? Get rid of this guy. And Carlos Marcello, he really wanted to kill Robert Kennedy, but as he himself said, yeah, but we can't, if we tear off the tail, the head can still bite you. So they knew they had to go for the president, Jack Kennedy. The military-industrial complex thought he was a danger and that he was cutting into them and that they had to get rid of him. And then the Texas oil men, they wanted to get rid of him.
And David Ben-Gurion.
Yes. When he refused to let Israel get the enriched uranium so they could build a nuclear force, you know, that now they got him.
Jack Kennedy said, we are going to inspect Dimona. And yes. Ben-Gurion said, you are not going to inspect. And he says, yes, we are. We're going to come in there. We're going to inspect it.
That's right. Now you're talking at the world level, the world power level. Now you're talking about the Rothschilds, Lord Rothschild, who is known as the father of modern Israel and is one of the most prominent of the Zionists. Now you got them angered, okay? Now, at that level, and then their minions, their representatives in North America, the Rockefellers, at that level, you're never going to be able to track this to any of those, but they had to go, you know, maybe it'd be best if he wasn't there. And once that consensus was reached, then it came down to people like Dulles, and who represented the Wall Street interest. It comes down to J. Edgar Hoover, who was the ultimate bureaucrat who would have gone along with anything to curry favor. And like I said, he was under the thumb of the mafia anyway. Mafia wanted him dead. And so I'm sure at the time, when I don't think you're going to have meetings amongst all of these people and not at the world level. But once it got to the point of consensus, everybody, there was a whole bunch of imperatives that came together. And at that point, then the word probably was passed that if something happened to him, nobody's going to get too upset. That then frees up J. Edgar Hoover and probably people within the CIA, probably Alan Dulles and Cord Meyer, people like this. And then the orders were passed down to the actual operational people, which I think was General Lansdale and Operation Mongoose, which was the secret war against Castro and involved elements of organized crime, the FBI, the CIA, the U.S. military, and all of them in there mixed up to include assassination. And they simply sent their teams to Dallas. And then they counted on the fact that it would be covered up from the highest levels of power, namely Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover. And I think that's exactly what happened. And so when you say, I know Courtney quite correctly calls it a coup d'etat, that's what it was. And it was a palace revolt. And I don't think you're ever going to be able to track it to any one particular individual.
No, you just wrapped it all up and put a bow on it. It's all there.
And here, let's take it up to another level, gentlemen. And this would be, I'll give another plug to Jim. It's such an honor to be on a show with Jim Mars. Take it to read his book, Rule by Secrecy. And if you're thinking, I was thinking on the level of, oh my goodness, how could they think they could get away with killing the president? Mm-hmm. Well, probably because they've been doing it throughout
for millennia,
this isn't
right?
The first time. yeah. It's been going on a long time.
Yeah. It just, actually, there's even, you know, we like to think, at the time, we thought that the Kennedy assassination was just an aberration and that, you know, something like that could never happen here. But if you really go back, you'll find that the first assassination attempt on U.S. president was like 1832 or something when they tried to kill Andrew Jackson because he was playing with the bankers. He was trying to stop the central bank. In fact, he did stop a central bank. bank, and then he went up against the international banking system, and they tried to kill him. And then you come forward, and you find out that there were assassination attempts and actual assassinations on McKinley and another one, and then there was an attack on Roosevelt in 1932, and then Truman in 1952 when the Puerto Rican separatists charged the White House with machine guns. I mean, yeah, it's happened all through history. We just don't get told about it day after day like the agendas that are given to us by the corporate mass media.
Yeah, and the Kennedy assassination was it was done in broad daylight, right in front of everybody, and it was a good warning to those
taught people a lesson.
Well, guys, it was a public execution. You know, think about it. The CIA has, you know, they've got poisons. They could have poisoned him with no trace. They could have caused a heart attack. They could have given him cancer. They could have arranged the crash of Air Force One. No, they blew his brains out in broad daylight in front of a crowd because it was a public execution, and it was carried out for the very same reason that we publicly execute criminals, to serve as a deterrent against anyone trying to follow in his footsteps and talk about world peace and talk about curtailing the powers of the corporations and talking about equality for all the people of this country. How dare he? You know, they just had to put a stop to that. They couldn't allow anybody to come along after him and try to follow in his footsteps.
No.
And let's face it, they haven't.
Not until now. Maybe. All right. We'll be right back. Hold on. Okay, remember, you can buy right now online and watch it, Dick Allgaier's remote viewing session of this subject matter tonight and our earlier visit, which is putting him right in Dealey Plaza at the time of the shooting. Extraordinary experiences to be able to watch and just contemplate what the human mind can do. It's an amazing feel, remote viewing. Okay, go ahead, Dick. Where are we?
Have we lost Dick?
I don't know.
No,
maybe
I'm here. I'm sorry. I'm here. I had my iPhone on mute while we were in the break. My mistake. Sorry.
Okay.
I'm here.
Where do you want to go next?
Well, I just want to say that remote viewing is really, it's full of surprises. I never would have thought that I would have experienced what I experienced. You know, we've all heard about the Kennedy assassination. I've actually worked that target 10 years, 20 years, 15 years, 10, 12 years ago. It leads you places you never expect. And
right.
it's just a real interesting thing to be an eyewitness to some of this and to hear feedback from Jim Mars.
It's fascinating.
Well, Dick, when I probably talked entirely too long, but when I made my explanations of what I thought about Human 1, 2, and 3, did that ring true to you, or was there kind of speculation?
It did. It actually is giving me chills to hear a lot of that because I didn't know a lot of that information. I was very unsure when I turned the session in. When I got feedback, I thought, I didn't do too good on that. I mean, I guess I got a meeting of some high-level people, but I would have thought, I would have consciously thought, if you would have told me a year ago, not in remote viewing, just as what I know, like who planned the Kennedy assassination, I would have said Alan Dulles. And I know he was an older guy with white hair and glasses. I would have said maybe some mafia people, some Secret Service people. What was the Secret Service role in this, Jim?
Well, there was a role. most of those Secret Service guys said, number one, you got to understand that their loyalty is to their service, not to any particular president. The driver of the car, William Greer, for example, had served, I think, like four presidents before Kennedy. And they were generally came from the ranks of the military or from law enforcement. And kind of like today, you don't find a lot of love for Obama among those groups, and you didn't find a lot of love for Jack Kennedy. And I think that when orders came down, they just followed the orders and probably played the role of Sergeant Schultz. You know, I see nothing, I hear nothing.
Well, I know, Jim, I'll never forget the picture movie of the one guy stepping off the car.
Throwing his arms
back,
up. Like, wait a minute, why are you telling me not to stand on the rear of the car?
Up. What are you doing? And he couldn't believe it. I'll never forget that.
That's right. But now let's follow that, because this will explain something else too. This guy obviously was not in on the plot.
Correct.
He was trying to do the normal security. He was going to ride on the little footrest and the hand grip on the rear of the car. And if they had been standing like that, that would have probably precluded a shot from the rear going to hitting Kennedy, because there would have been a body in front of him.
Yeah.
But at Love Field, they were suddenly called off by their superior. Okay? Now, he throws up his arms. What's this all about? Wait a minute. What? Okay, but then he doesn't think a whole lot more about it until the assassination happens. And then, I'm sure, late at night, he's going, holy crap.
Oh, yeah.
Man, you know. But he knows the power is shifted. Lyndon Johnson's now president. His bosses, doesn't seem to be too interested in pursuing anything other than the lone nut scenario. So he, if he wants to keep his job, if he wants to keep his pension, if some, maybe even to keep his life and that of his family,
I think that's
maybe he just
correct.
Better go along with it.
Did Greer, do you think Greer was in on it?
I can't say for sure. I don't want to say yes, but I will say that his testimony is at odds with his actions. His testimony to the Warren Commission was that he didn't even know the assassination was happening until Kellerman next to him says, "We're hit, get us out of here," at which time he stepped on the gas as per Secret Service regulations, which says the first sign of trouble, you step on the gas and you get out of there. And he steps on the gas and the car accelerated. But if you look at the films, particularly the Nix film, the car turns onto Elm Street and begins to slow, and then the brake lights come on,
and it
slows to almost a complete stop with Greer looking back over his right shoulder at Kennedy until after the fatal headshot is delivered, and only then does he face forward, and the brake lights go off, and the car accelerates.
Where did he stop the car? In the kill zone, clearly marked on the curbs.
Right, by the yellow paint.
Yep. Go back and listen to our first program, folks, and it's a perfect companion to this one. You'll see the kill zone marked on the street that very morning. They painted yellow on the curb, about 4 feet of yellow on all four curbs or four locations.
No, it was two-foot streaks on the south curb of Elm Street, about 10 feet apart.
Only
and
the
right
south
in between
curb,
those marks is where the headshot took place.
Yeah, I got it. All right. Yeah, this is fascinating.
Okay, well, I got to tell you that we've been highlighting a lot of my work. Deb Smith already also did some amazing work on this. He's in the video, and I know you're going to have Daz and Courtney on, Jeff.
29.
And Daz, actually, the shooting itself, I never really saw Kennedy or described Kennedy. I sensed the shooters, but I was more focused on the crowd reaction. Daz focused on the limousine itself. And then as for the planners, and Daz again did those targets with two other targets in between and a month or I think he might have been 2 or 3 months apart. Mm-hmm. He was on a different time scale than me. We never communicated.
Mm-hmm.
And Daz has more of the meeting, and there were several meetings. Jim alluded to that, and I'll let Daz describe all of that.
Well, we'll do that on the 29th. Now, my question is, we're going to pull back here and ask a bigger question, Dick. Remote viewing obviously works, extremely well. Does this not present to the world elite a little bit of a problem? Because you're looking at stuff in the past. We're able to look at things through remote viewing in the current time milieu and in the future.
And we've done some experiments on that. You never know. There may be some more experiments on that in the future. Never know.
Okay.
I wondered when after that first show we did,
mm-hmm.
a lot of that information I didn't know. When I listened to Jim describe and verify a lot of my stuff, I kind of sat back and went, holy crap, I knew this worked, but I bet there's people that don't want me to be able to do this. You know, I mean, it's...
I'm sure the other viewers who are still at work...
Well, wait a minute. Without going into anything, hasn't there already been some attempts to stop you from what you're doing?
We don't want to go there. But let me suggest that the other viewers who are working on contracts for corporations are doing the same kinds of things. They're going into places where they shouldn't go or aren't wanted to go by the opposition, the target. I mean, remote viewers can go into a locked safe and read documents in envelopes.
Yes.
Okay?
That's so dumb.
I can't do that. I can't do that. I've gone in maybe I can. I did do a target one. Okay, I did stick my head in the safe. I can't read documents, but, you know.
Was the safe the target?
You'll have to ask. Pardon me?
Was the safe the target, and you were told when you got
no,
there?
No, I did a remote viewing one time. A client asked us about somebody was embezzling something, and we wanted to know if he was really embezzling. And I saw someone with two sets of books, and he had a safe. And I said, "Oh, what's in the safe? I'll look in there." And mm-hmm. I did, and I saw some stuff, but I can't read documents.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have to ask Courtney about this. Courtney believes that we're being allowed to do some of these targets, like 9/11 and the JFK. There are people in control that want this out, and it's being permitted. I said, Courtney, when I found out we did 9/11, I said, man, we're going to get in trouble. And he said, no, I think we're being permitted. They know what we're doing. We don't hide anything, and it's being allowed. There are factions that want it to come out.
Well, I know.
I don't know if that's...
Go ahead.
Well, that's because there are some people who feel like they're in such control, they don't care whether the public knows about it or not.
There's an arrogance out there that is, it defies description. It's that, you're right, totally right.
We may amuse them. They may listen and go, well, they got some of that right, isn't that good, but they can't do anything about it.
That's right.
No.
Yeah, we're in charge. What are you going to do about it?
That's right. All true. I would urge all of you to go back and listen to the first program. These will be together in a featured story on the right side of the page. And you can look at the photos as well. Fascinating. Dick Allgaier, thank you very much for sharing this. Thanks to Courtney Brown as well. We'll talk to Courtney and Daz Smith on the 29th with Jim and get Daz's take on what he saw when he was given the same target to work. And that was the day... 11/22/63. Thank you very much, Dick. Take care.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Dick. You're one heck of a remote viewer.
Thank you.
Jim, we again heard something tonight that is absolutely phenomenal. Phenomenal.
Well, I think people, I've found in my lifetime that people, when they hear truth, it resonates. They understand it's true.
Yeah.
So we'll just see if the people who listen to this particular program, do they feel like it's true or not.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Adios.
See you soon.
Aloha.
Jim Mars and Dick Allgaier. Okay, we'll be back with you tomorrow night. You take care. Talk soon.